So let's start this next session. So as I mentioned before lunch, this session we're going to devote to the loving kindness and compassion practices. One of the main reasons, of course, here is that we need to have some balance in our shamatha practice, and that if we only practice shamatha, then to the exclusion of the other practices, then there's a great danger that we can use shamatha practice as a way of withdrawing from the world, withdrawing into our little bubble of peace. So that's not a very healthy approach. So we need to stay connected in the world. So we need to really balance our shamatha practice with this practice of loving kindness and compassion. So let's have a little bit look at what they are, and we're going to do a meditation on them, and then a few things I want to mention after the meditation. So first is the loving kindness. It is a translation of the Sanskrit word maitri or the Pali word metta. And here, loving kindness is simply the wish for ourselves and others to be happy. Or in other words, the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. Compassion, or karuna in Sanskrit and Pali, is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. Now, within the Buddhist spiritual path, we are to cultivate these two qualities towards all sentient beings, meaning we are to cultivate loving kindness and compassion to all sentient beings. And it's very much recommended in the meditation texts on these practices to cultivate this in stages, that we first start by cultivating loving kindness and compassion towards our so-called friends, people who are close to. It's the easiest thing to do. Then to expand that out to include people that we don't know very well, the so-called strangers. And once we're comfortable doing that, then to start to expand it out to people we find difficult, the so-called enemy. And then eventually out to all sentient beings. That's how it's traditionally presented in the texts. But again, I think in our modern day society, we may need to add an extra step right at the beginning. And that is to cultivate loving kindness and compassion toward ourselves. Again, that's not something that was hugely emphasized in the early texts, because I think in general, in centuries earlier, people felt okay about themselves, you know, tended to feel okay about themselves. Where unfortunately in our modern day society, that often is not the case. We don't feel very good about ourselves. We're not kind or compassionate to ourselves. We suffer often low self-esteem and even some self-hatred. So, of course, if we're not kind and compassionate toward ourselves, we're not going to be able to extend that out to others. So I think for many of us, probably we'll need to start there, to develop really loving kindness and compassion for ourselves first, then slowly extend it out from there. Now, there are a number of ways to cultivate this. Within Tibetan Buddhism, then there's a very powerful practice called Tonglen. Tonglen is a Tibetan word which literally means giving and taking. This is very widely practiced in all the Tibetan Buddhist schools. A very powerful method for not only cultivating loving kindness and compassion for ourselves and others, but also a very powerful method for overcoming our self-centered, self-cherishing attitude and really cultivating an attitude of cherishing others. So what I'd like to do is briefly explain the practice. We're going to do this practice and then a few comments after that. Now, in this practice, when it's called giving and taking, what we're doing in this practice is we are imagining taking on the suffering of others, and we're imagining giving our happiness away to them. This is a very powerful method, because the last thing
self-cherishing mind would want to do would be to take on any suffering from anyone. The last thing the self-cherishing mind would want to do would be to give away any happiness to anyone. So by imagining doing that, we are really crushing this selfish, self-centered attitude and really developing this attitude of cherishing others. Or in other words, we really are transforming our attachment aversion into loving kindness and compassion. Now, how to do this? Through visualization, there are a number of ways. Probably the most common way that's taught is involving what's called the visualizing this black rock of self-cherishing at the heart. I prefer to use a slight different variation of that practice, and so I'll explain that variation. Because also in Buddhism, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, we can talk about this idea of Buddha nature, this sort of potential for enlightenment, you know, that because at our deepest level, our mind is intrinsically pure by nature, therefore we have the potential for enlightenment. No matter how much mental afflictions such as anger and jealousy and craving, fear, anxiety, depression, no matter how many of these mental afflictions are covering the surface of our mind, underneath this is this natural purity of mind, and this, because of this, we can achieve enlightenment. This is often termed Buddha nature. So in this meditation, then, we can visualize this inner quality, this Buddha nature, and use that within the practice. And it'll become obvious as I lead the meditation what the visualization is. So I won't go in any detail now because it's very clear through the meditation practice. But one or two things to mention before we do the practice, and that is when people first hear about this practice, this idea of imagining taking on someone's suffering, imagining giving away the happiness, often people come up with this doubt, you know, ooh, but if I imagine taking on, you know, someone's illness, you know, maybe I'll get their illness. And so people go, oh, I don't want to do this practice. So, of course, we're only imagining doing this, so we can't actually take the illness from them. But then people say, well, if that's the case, then what's the point of doing this practice if we can't actually take any suffering from anyone directly? The point of this exercise is to reduce and eliminate our self-cherishing mind, to increase our mind of loving kindness and compassion to others. So if we're doing this process, that's the result that we're going to get, which means outside of the meditation, when we actually go to help someone, we'll go to help them in a much more pure way rather than with our own agenda. And often now, of course, if the person who's got some problem or suffering is not someone close to us, we may not even bother helping them because we think, well, that's their problem. It's nothing to do with me. So with this practice, we'll even start to help more and more people. So that's how this practice works. It works through us transforming our mind so that we can really help others in a better way. But also at a more subtle level, and I think there's some scientific evidence to support this, is that if we really do this imagination, this visualization with someone we know and really want to take their suffering away from them, that I think we can have a direct positive impact on their mind, even if they're on the other side of the planet. And I think there is some scientific evidence to support that idea. So we can actually have a direct positive impact on their mind. And we sort of know that at a very basic level. For example, if someone walks into the room who's radiating love and compassion, without them even saying anything, they can have an immediate positive impact on our mind. So it can work at this subtle level as well. So what I'd like to do then is to work on cultivating loving kindness and compassion using this practice now and use it as two stages. First, with ourselves, and then we'll move on to someone close to us. Okay? So again, I think it'll be fairly self-explanatory, the visualization as I go guide the meditation, and then there'll be some time for any questions about the practice after. Okay? So let's do that practice now. So again, finding that nice, comfortable posture. Keeping the back nice and straight. And the body completely relaxed, completely at ease. And using your out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Simply letting go of all thoughts of the past or the future, and allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Tonglen is Tibetan for giving and taking. It's a very powerful method to transform self-cherishing into the attitude of cherishing others. To transform our attachment and aversion into loving kindness and compassion. And we can begin by using the Tonglen practice to cultivate loving kindness and compassion for ourselves. no matter how much mental afflictions, such as attachment and anger and jealousy and fear, anxiety and depression, no matter how much of these mental afflictions are covering the surface of our mind, underneath these mental afflictions is the natural purity of our mind. This natural purity of mind is often called Buddha nature, our potential to reach the highest goals imaginable. So imagine this deepest dimension of your mind in the form of a small, white, radiant sphere of light in the center of your chest, at the level of your heart. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if I were free of suffering and its causes, free of the mental afflictions. May I be free of all suffering and its causes. And then imagine your mental afflictions and your present and future suffering in the form of black smoke filling your body. And then with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing your mental afflictions and suffering at your heart. Now imagine that that black smoke of mental afflictions and suffering is completely extinguished. And now you're free of all suffering and its causes. And take joy in this. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if I had happiness and its causes. May I be truly well and happy. And then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from the sphere of light at your heart, filling and saturating your entire body and mind, and transforming into everything you need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving-kindness, sending to yourself whatever you need to be happy. And then imagine now you've actually found the genuine happiness that you seek. And take delight in this. And just as you wish to be free of suffering and to find happiness, so does everyone else. So next, bring to mind someone close to you, a friend, a loved one, who's currently experiencing some sort of physical or mental problem or suffering. And picture them very clearly seated in front of you. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they were free of that problem, free of that suffering. May you be free of all suffering and its causes. And then imagine their problem or suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. And then with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke out of their body and bringing it into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their suffering at your heart. And imagine now that black smoke is completely extinguished. And now they're completely free of that problem, free of that suffering. Take joy in this. and then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they had happiness and its causes. May you be truly well and happy. And then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from the sphere of light at your heart, filling and saturating their entire body and mind, and transforming into everything they need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending to them whatever they need to be happy. Imagine that they've now found the true happiness that they seek. Take joy in this. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting in awareness itself. Simply being aware of being aware. Resting within luminously clear awareness. So slowly bringing the meditation to a close. And there's a few things I want to discuss, but before that, is there any questions about that actual meditation? Any confusion or doubts? Okay. So we talked here about loving kindness. And so we're talking about cultivating that to not just ourselves, but towards everyone. And also within Buddhism, there's a lot of talk about attachment. and that we need to eliminate attachment. But then often there's a bit of a confusion there, because often, sometimes, loving kindness and attachment sort of seem to be similar or the same even. So often the doubt is that, you know, if I get rid of my attachment, then, you know, it's going to be difficult to have any sort of relationship with anyone, you know, because it seems like attachment's necessary. Now, part of the confusion there is, again, as I mentioned on Friday night, the word, terminology. Because this word attachment in Buddhism is used quite differently than it is in psychology. In psychology, attachment often has a very positive flavor. In fact, there are certain forms of attachment we need to actively cultivate to be healthy. In adult attachment theory, for example. And so here it's not so much that Buddhism and psychology are arguing different of opinion. It's more about terminology. So this word attachment in psychology, I've got a couple of definitions for the word attachment in psychology here. One is that attachment is an enduring emotional tie to a special person, characterized by a tendency to seek and maintain closeness, especially during times of stress. Another definition of attachment in psychology is, attachment is a feeling that binds one to a person, thing, cause, or the like. Another definition, attachment is a feeling of affection for a person. And some synonyms for the word attachment in psychology is affection, devotion, regard, loyalty, love. So this is very different to how that term is used in Buddhism. The word attachment in Buddhism is defined as a mental factor that sees its object as attractive, it exaggerates the object's attractiveness, and then wishes to possess and hold the object. Why? Because it believes that object is a source of our happiness. So, attachment in Buddhism is a mental affliction that really distorts things. It exaggerates things. It sees that the object is a source of our happiness and then wishes to possess and hold the object. So, in a relationship, attachment is really all about me. And attachment then views the other person as an object to satisfy me. So that is quite different than how attachment, that same word is used in psychology. So we need to be aware of that. Otherwise, there'll be a lot of confusion. And so this word that's attachment in Buddhism then, of course, is very different from love or loving kindness. Because here, remember, loving kindness is the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. And so, therefore, in a relationship, when we talk about loving kindness to the partner, we're talking about the wish for them to be happy. And in the fine print, without expecting anything in return, what we would call unconditional love, no strings attached love. Conditional love, or strings attached love, is love polluted by attachment. And that sounds like this. Love polluted by attachment is, I will love you as long as, and here comes the condition, as long as you keep saying and doing things that make me happy. Otherwise, no. So that is love polluted by attachment. So the very easy way to distinguish love and attachment in a relationship is simply love is saying, I want you to be happy. Attachment is saying, I want you to make me happy. So there's a huge difference between love and attachment in a relationship. Attachment is always destructive. It's always interfering with our relationships. Normally we think there's just one dynamic going on there, but actually there's two dynamics in our relationships. There is an aspect of genuine love, of wishing them to be happy, and then usually mixed with that is this aspect of hoping or wanting them to make us happy. This is attachment. So the more attachment we have, the more problematic. So what we are to do, of course, is to distinguish that there's two dynamics in relationships, to increase the love part and to decrease the attachment part of a relationship. Also on this point, another confusion is we talk about here developing equal loving kindness and compassion for everyone. And then people get a bit confused about that, thinking that they have to behave equally with everyone, they have to spend equal amount of time with everyone. This is not true. Loving kindness is not a behavior. Loving kindness is an aspiration. In fact, that's why it's much better to translate maitri and metta as loving kindness than love. Because love in our English language is an emotion and usually implies some sort of intimate behavior. Whereas maitri and metta is not actually an emotion. It's definitely not a behavior and it's not an emotion. It's an aspiration. It's a wish for ourselves and others to be happy. So therefore it's better to translate as loving kindness. So when we talk about equal loving kindness to everyone, we're talking about an equal attitude to everyone. That equally we wish everyone to be happy. How that attitude would be expressed in our behavior would be completely dependent on our relationship to that person. To our partner, we would express that loving kindness in a very intimate way and spend a lot of time with them. To our family members, we would express that same loving kindness in a very different way. To our neighbors and work colleagues, we would express that same loving kindness in a very different way and maybe not spend hardly any time with them. So when we talk about equal loving kindness, we're talking about equal attitude, not equal behavior. So I think these are some things we need to keep in mind. Otherwise, we have a lot of confusion about what really love or loving kindness is and what to do with attachment. Any questions about loving kindness versus attachment?
One does come across a lot of very non-materialistic people who are nevertheless very attached to people.
And their ideas. And their ideas. We can be very much attached to our ideas, no? Not very open and flexible. So we can be attached to everything. Anything. Anything. So yeah, sure. Attached to a person and an object is different. But actually, when we're attached to a person, attachment sees the person as an object to satisfy me. So it actually is quite dehumanizing, attachment. It's just looking at all these things as something to satisfy me, something to make me happy. So it's not very nice, you know. We wouldn't feel nice if someone else is viewing us as an object of their satisfaction, to satisfy them, would we? So this is really what attachment does. And also the thing we need to remember is, in fact, in general with mental afflictions, there's a factor of distortion. It's this factor of exaggeration. Both with attachment and anger, there's a distortion, there's an exaggeration. And we know this very well, that often when we come into contact with a person or thing that we find pleasurable, attachment really magnifies that beauty in the person or thing, distorts it completely, and then of course after some time we start to see through that, and then we go, well, you know, we talk about love at first sight. Often it's actually attachment at first sight, and then after a couple of weeks we often think, what did I see in that person? Was I crazy or something? You know, and often that's the case, is that it's attachment that is completely distorting, exaggerating qualities of people and things. And certainly there's always this idea that this person or thing is going to make me happy. They're the source of my happiness. So that's only going to bring us grief, drama, problem. Yes. Right. So again, that often comes in psychology, in attachment, adult attachment theory. So there, this bond between mother and child is said to be attachment, and we need to have that healthy bond. That healthy bond between mother and child is not attachment in Buddhism. Of course, it can be corrupted and polluted by attachment. Then that healthy bond becomes completely unhealthy. You know, sometimes we see to the point where the parent wraps up their child in cotton wool and doesn't let them do anything. And then, of course, they don't develop as a person, and then there's big problems later in life because they want to protect them. And that is attachment. So that's very unhealthy. So, again, the problem or the confusion here is that that strong bond between mother and child in a pure form has no attachment in it, according to Buddhism. Yet that strong bond between mother and child is called attachment within psychology. So that's why there's a lot of confusion.
But there's also a lot of cultural tinges to it.
Oh, of course. Of course.
In the Indian context.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, there are a lot of cultural things. But, I mean, again, in general, we need to have that healthy bond, not between, not just mother and child, between partners, between family, friends, everyone. We need to have that healthy bond to everyone. And that healthy bond is the bond of loving kindness in Buddhism and compassion. Yes. Okay.
Loving kindness. A lot of people within a marriage have a kind of awesome relationship.
Yes. In fact, with attachment, it does not allow that. Because with attachment comes expectation. Because our attachment is saying, that person is making me happy, so I expect them to do this and say this and that to make me happy. So if we get rid of attachment, we have pure loving kindness, that will facilitate a very open relationship. Very much so. Yeah, and then of course, with everything, as we see in Buddhism, we have these two wings of wisdom and compassion. You know, loving kindness is on the compassion side. We have to have wisdom. Otherwise, compassion and loving kindness is blind. And then it can be really problematic. So, of course, we need to have wisdom in everything we do. So, I mean, really, pure loving kindness can't exist without wisdom. So when we say pure loving kindness, it's sort of assumed that wisdom is there. Otherwise, it's not pure. So this is what we need to, of course, bring into the equation. And that's why so many people have problems with compassion, trying to help others, is they don't bring the wisdom in, and then there's all sorts of problems. But of course, wisdom comes at many levels. The sixth paramita often is talking about the wisdom realizing the nature of reality. But of course, at a more conventional level, we can have the wisdom of not allowing people to take advantage of us and all these sorts of wisdoms. This we can develop, of course, from day one, this sort of wisdom. Okay, the second point I want to mention before we go for an afternoon tea break before I go on, is there anything else about loving kindness, attachment? Okay. Sorry, I didn't catch. You did?
Even in the Indian context, very often the relationship between a mother and a child is tinged by attachment.
Of course. And forget about Indian context, world context. Human
context.
Yeah, so human attachment, right. Yeah.
So indulgent with that child allows sometimes shabby behavior to pass through.
And that's not going to be very good for the... Exactly. Exactly. So it's not healthy for the child, not healthy for the parent. Exactly. Exactly. So that's the wisdom missing. Yeah, of course. I think that's not just an Indian thing. It's a worldwide phenomenon, a human condition. Okay. Second point I want to bring up is to do with compassion. You know, we talk about developing this compassion to not just ourselves, but everyone. And generally people find it quite easy to develop compassion to people close to them, to people they don't know very well, a little bit more difficult. But then when it comes to compassion to people who behave badly, particularly towards ourselves, then it becomes extremely difficult, even to the point where we often think, actually, they don't deserve compassion. They deserve to suffer. So that's one thing. So why is it that we find it so difficult to have forgiveness and compassion for people who behave badly? That's one point. But related to that is also in our modern society this epidemic of low self-esteem and self-hatred. Why don't we feel good about ourselves? Why is there this guilt, low self-esteem, self-hatred, so epidemic, that it didn't really seem to exist in earlier societies? In fact, in Tibetan, there's no word for guilt. It doesn't exist. So, you know, what's that all about? So these two things are actually intimately related, and that's what I'd like to talk about now. And there's a simple reason why these things occur. So let's say we see someone who's doing some bad or harmful behavior. So the correct perspective is simply that. There's a person who's doing some bad or harmful action. But often in these situations, that's not the perspective that we adopt. Rather, often when we see such a situation, we simply see or say, there's a bad person, or there's a nasty person, there's a horrible person, an evil person. So what we've done is what's called cognitive fusion, is that we have identified or fused the person to their behavior. We've made them one thing. So that's what fusion means, and cognitive means mentally do that. We mentally fuse the person to their behavior. That's often how we see the situation. This, of course, is a wrong perspective. Because there are two things here. There are a person and their behavior. If we do cognitive fusion, and unfortunately, our language and our society and culture are programming us really to think and speak in this way, if we end up having this perspective, we're in big trouble. Because in any situation, we can only do one of two things, really. We can either accept or reject. And if we do cognitive fusion, and we have such a situation, then, of course, generally we reject the situation. But if we do cognitive fusion, what we end up doing is rejecting the person. Meaning we attack the person, we get angry at the person. Because what is it that we don't like? It's the behavior we don't like, that we don't agree with. But if we fuse it to the person, what we end up doing is we end up attacking the person and get angry at the person. But then, of course, if we understand attacking the person is not the right thing to do, but if we do cognitive fusion, then we've nullified the reject option. We can't do that because rejecting the person, getting angry at the person is not right. So the only other option is accept. So what do? We end up accepting their bad behavior. And often we do that with people close to us because we don't want to attack them. So we simply accept their bad behavior.
And so both of these options, which are really the only two options available to us when we do this, are problematic. They're just going to bring problems. They're not going to solve anything. And so therefore, to develop loving kindness, to develop compassion or forgiveness for a person when we see them like this, it becomes almost impossible. Because to have forgiveness or compassion for a bad person feels like what we're saying, oh, what you did was okay, I don't mind. Of course we should mind. Of course it's not okay for their bad behavior. But if we do cognitive fusion, that's the result. That's the result. We can't give them because we say they don't deserve it because they're a bad person. They don't deserve forgiveness or compassion. Therefore, we find it almost impossible to have forgiveness or compassion because somehow if we do that in this way, we feel it seems like we're condoning their behavior. We're sort of saying that we're being weak, that we're accepting their bad behavior. So that's why it's very difficult to have compassion for people if we do cognitive fusion. Also, of course, if we do this, more problems. Because if we've identified the person with their bad behavior, we see them as a bad person, then it becomes very difficult to acknowledge their good qualities. Because good people don't have, bad people don't have good qualities. They're as good or bad. So if we've labeled them, if we see them as a bad person, then that's it. They're a bad person. So often we can't see any good qualities because it's not possible. A bad person doesn't have good qualities. They're bad. So this is the problem. So, of course, the simple solution is don't do cognitive fusion because it's a wrong perspective. It's false. Because the correct perspective is there is a person doing this bad action. And so if we have the correct perspective, then, again, accept and reject, meaning we can accept the person, meaning have forgiveness and compassion for the person, and at the same time reject their bad behavior. So then we address their bad behavior and we don't accept it. So this is a very simple solution, and it's actually the correct perspective to see it in this way. So then we can have forgiveness and compassion for the person, and at the same time not tolerate their bad behavior and address their bad behavior and be very strong about their bad behavior without attacking the person. So if we can do this, if we can reprogram the way we speak and think, I think you'll find it much easier to have compassion for people who behave badly and yet at the same time not accept their bad behavior and really work to help that person overcome their bad behavior. Then, of course, we can make some progress in those difficult situations. Any questions about this? Yeah. So what he's saying, when he's saying turn the other cheek, he's saying to not do this. But what we need to be careful of is that if we do cognitive fusion, turn the other cheek means we do this. That's not acceptable. So I think when Ganiji says turn the other cheek, he's saying don't attack the person, don't get angry at the person. But if that person is engaging in harmful behavior that's harmful to them and others, then with compassion, we try to help that person. Because if we don't turn the other cheek, if we attack the person by slapping them back, then the whole thing gets out of control, doesn't it? So this is the key element here, is as long as we do cognitive fusion, turn the other cheek is a disaster. Because we just do this. So the problem is, we need to understand this is the false perspective. If we understand the correct perspective, turn the other cheek will be automatic,
And at the same time, we will not accept their bad behavior. It becomes an automatic thing. That's why, as you mentioned, there people find it difficult to accept this turn the other cheek, because they're stuck here, and for them to turn the other cheek means they can't do this, so the only thing left is that they have to do this, which is not good. This is not going to lead to any good solution. That's why people get themselves exploited, because they believe that reacting with is not the right thing, so then all they do is they end up as the victim, and they get exploited, and people walk over the top of them. Is that you? That's not helpful. But these are the two sort of extremes that we get caught in. Because we're doing this, we sort of oscillate between these two. And both of them are not helpful. The reason that we do them is because we have this wrong perspective operating in our lives. If we fix our perspective, then things will sort themselves out. Stop there. I'm happy you brought that up. We're not separating. This is an extreme. The two extremes is identifying and disassociating. This is not disassociating. There's this line here. So we tend to do one of those. We either identify or disassociate. So we're not talking about separating the person and the action. You can't. You can't have a person separate from the action. What we're talking about here is associating, distinguishing the person from their behavior. But of course they're associated. They're not separated. So we need to be careful of that. Because otherwise we can go from this to the other extreme and go, I didn't do it. Wasn't me. They didn't do it. No, I thought so, but I thought I'd bring it in because this is often what people think, is that to overcome this they need to separate them, disassociate. But this is the other extreme. Go on, sorry. Correct, correct. Not dissociate. Distinguish. Well, because there is a person and there is a behavior. The person is not the behavior. But the person and the behavior, of course, are related. You can't have behavior without person. So that's what this is saying. That's what we need to understand. Sure. So, yes, we can say that the person, I mean, everyone just wants to be happy. We all have mental afflictions, which means sometimes we behave in a harmful way, thinking that this is the source to happiness. So that's why we can have compassion for the person and at the same time not accept their behavior. We can really be very strong on their behavior. We can be very forceful, you know, if they're really doing physical harm, intentionally or not, we can be really forceful on that and say, we won't accept that bad behavior. That is harmful. That is not good behavior. I will not tolerate that behavior. We have to be very strong on that. Otherwise, we end up doing this. So that's not going to lead anywhere. That's why, you know, the point we brought up here, you know, turn the other cheek is great, but if we're doing this, we end up doing that by turning the other cheek. And that's disaster. It's a disaster, isn't it? Because then we get victimized and we allow people. In fact, are we being compassionate to a person if we're allowing them to do harmful behavior? No, because we're encouraging them to behave badly. That's not helping them. So real compassion is, you know, often people think compassion is weak. You know, oh, compassion is a sign of weakness. Yes, if we're doing this sort of compassion. But real compassion is saying that behavior is creating a lot of suffering for other people and that person. So if I want to be compassionate to the person, I need to try and help that person in whatever way I can to stop them behaving like that. That's real compassion. So actually compassion is a very sign of strength.
Yeah? Accept bad behavior.
Okay, I think we're running out of time here. Yes, let me just, one more point that I think is very important again in our modern society is this idea of guilt, low self-esteem, and self-hatred. So this is respect to other people. We can also do this with respect to ourselves. I am doing a bad action, or I have done a bad action, is the correct perspective. To acknowledge, yes, I just have done a bad action. Again, often we don't see it like that. We simply see, I am a bad person. And so, of course, if we identify ourselves with our negative behavior, negative thoughts, negative emotions, and cognitive fusion, we're in big trouble. Because, again, we can only accept or reject. If we reject, we attack ourselves. We beat ourselves up. We have low self-esteem and self-hatred. And, or, the other thing is that we deny, or we just don't worry. We simply accept our bad behavior if we don't attack ourselves, because we do cognitive fusion. So again, if we simply avoid cognitive fusion, if we simply acknowledge, I have done a bad action, we can have compassion for ourselves, meaning we can feel good about ourselves, but at the same time not tolerate our negative behavior and address our negative behavior and work to overcome it. This is the same idea as guilt. If we've done something harmful and we feel guilty, what are we focusing on if we feel guilty? Bad me, bad me. So therefore, we hate ourselves, we attack ourselves, and we're not even looking at our bad behavior, so we're not even addressing the bad behavior. So guilt is completely useless. It's based on cognitive fusion. It just makes us feel bad, paralyzed, and stuck. Whereas if we have done some harmful behavior and we regret, what are we focusing on when we regret? We're regretting the behavior. So regret is coming from correct perspective by simply acknowledging, I have done this harmful action. I regret this action, meaning we can address it and overcome it, and at the same time still feel good about ourselves, have compassion for ourselves. So whether it's with respect to ourselves or others, if we do cognitive fusion, huge mess. Mental afflictions, we get anger, everything. There was one more thing I wanted to mention there. Yeah, okay. Yes, and then we'll wait for tea, is cognitive fusion is we're identifying ourselves with our thoughts, our emotions, our habits, our memories, everything. We are none of these things. Either we are our thoughts or we have thoughts. Are we our thoughts or do we have thoughts? We have thoughts. Are we our emotions or do we have emotions? We have emotions. But our language supports cognitive fusion. For example, if some anger is coming up in our mind, what do we usually think? I am angry. Disaster. All we've done is we've identified ourselves with anger. We've just said, there you go, anger, you're the boss, away you go. Big mess. Because what's happening is there's anger arising in our mind. We are not anger. We have angry thought or angry emotion in our mind. We are not anger. So therefore, rather than saying, I am angry, just saying there is some anger coming up in my mind, already it feels like lighter. It's not me. It's like this thing coming up in our mind. In fact, when I mentioned this some years ago, there was a lady in the audience who afterwards she said, oh, that's interesting. She says, I use this technique with my little children, you know, because kids get caught up in their tantrums and so forth. She had, I think, 2 kids, 3 and 4 or something years old, or 4 and 5. And she said when they started to get angry, she would say, look, there's that anger thing coming up in your mind again. And it forced the child to look at their anger going, what, where is it, what? And she said it was very helpful to help them not get caught up in their anger, because it forced them to see anger as an object. Because anger is an object. It's something appearing in our mind. It's not us. Likewise, we are not our habits. You know, we have habits. You know, how often do we hear people say, I'm an angry person, that's me, you've got to accept that. Rubbish. There's no such thing as an angry person. There are only people who maybe have a strong habit of being angry. It's just a habit, means we can change it. Same, we are not our personality. You know, that's my personality, that's me, you better accept that. We are not our personality, we have personality, which means we can change it. All of these things which we can change. If we identify with any of these things, we're setting ourselves up for a lot of unnecessary grief and suffering. So if we can really appreciate this correct perspective, that these are all things which we have, then we can work with them, we can change them, we can increase the positive habits and emotions and thoughts, we can decrease the negative ones and work to eliminate them. But if we do cognitive fusion, we're really stuck, because we think we just feel stuck. There's no hope of change, because that's me.
But just in Western psychology, there is always this notion of accepting that you are that.
Acceptance.
If you read Eric Byrne or particularly
Byrne. I don't know. But of course we need acceptance. But the problem is if we do cognitive fusion. I think that's not helpful. Because if we practice acceptance, we need to practice self-acceptance. But if we do cognitive fusion with self-acceptance, it's a disaster. You know, if we self-accept, I'm an angry person, we're stuck. What healthy self-acceptance is acknowledging I have a strong habit of getting angry. That's self-acceptance. I have that strong habit. I accept that. But if we accept I'm an angry person, we're in big trouble. Because that's me. You better accept that, because that's it. No hope of change. So this is healthy self-acceptance. This is pathological self-acceptance.
I think
anger is arising. Exactly. No. If we accept I am angry, no. Yeah. Exactly, that's this. Is to acknowledge and see, yes, there is some anger arising in my mind now, and not to suppress it or get caught up in it. Because cognitive fusion is getting caught up in our anger. And the other one is suppressing it. They're the two extremes. Self-acceptance is this, in the middle, is to not suppress, not deny, but not get caught up in it, not identify, not cognitive fusion, but simply acknowledge there is some anger arising in my mind now. And then we have some breathing space and we can do something with it and not get overwhelmed by it. But anyway, I think it's time for a tea break. So let's have a tea break, 20-minute tea break, and come back at 3:30.